Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope that you've had a wonderful day. I'm in the process of putting out some new videos and interesting little mixes based on some of the hearings that have occurred around H.R. 3717 and different interviews that Tim Murphy and Ron Barber have done concerning their bills, and it's been a busy day in those ways. But this is a open lines call-in show, and so I'd like to invite you to call in and be part of the program. You can do that by calling area code 267-521-0167. It's area code 267-521-0167 to be a part of the program. If you need a toll-free line, you can call area code 855-346-3351 toll-free. That's area code 855-346-3351. As Yvonne says, grab a pen and some paper because there's going to be all kinds of information that gets discussed. We never know who winds up calling in. It is an open line, anything goes kind of show. So you never know what kind of information that we'll be getting, and that includes myself. So I'm excited to have another night of broadcasting, and one of the things I would like to call your attention to was an article that was written, on HopeWorks Community, and which you can find at the short URL is N as in Nancy, B as in boy, L as in love, O as in over, dot G as in go, S as in Sam, / Y A L N as in Nancy, K. And it's a letter that says, "Dear Rep. Murphy, on the meaning of reprehensible." Larry Drain writes, "You say that it is morally reprehensible for anyone to help a patient question the medical advice of a professional gives him." And just to give a little bit of background to this, and anybody who knows more than I do about this, please call in, because I'm sure there are people who know more about this than I do. But it seems that in recent days, they have there's been a challenge about any advocate speaking out or giving some kind of support or advocacy for somebody who is trying to question the medical advice the psychiatrist is giving them. And so I think that this is really a big issue for anybody who's an advocate, because it seriously will limit what it is that we can do. And again, I'm not sure what the actual legality is, whether it will become illegal to assist somebody in trying to get out of psychiatric, or if it will just be something that will not be funded or looked down upon or what. I mean, it's already looked down upon by some, I guess. But I'm not sure what the legalities are. So if anybody knows this, if you can call in at 267-521-0167 and let us know, that would be great. But part of what the response here is, let me tell you about reprehensible. Where I live, and this is not written by me, this is, I believe, by Larry Drain, on community, HopeWorks Community. Where I live, bipolar disorder is as much a function of the doctor you go to as the symptoms you display. One doctor basically believes everyone is bipolar. He says that the fact he consults and does, quote, education for a pharmaceutical company has nothing to do with it. Another talks about people, quote, feeling bipolar to him. They never seem to have the right symptoms for the right period of time, but still, the psychiatrist at the psychiatric unit basically doesn't believe anyone is bipolar. He thinks it is way overdiagnosed and way overdramatized. He normally cures people from bipolar really fast. He just tells them that they don't have it. Considering they deal in, quote, medical science, that seems reprehensible to me. How do people know which expert not to question, since the three of them sometimes tell people diametrically opposite things? And I think this is one of the things that we really, you know, have continually talked about on this show, and that many people have talked about for decades, that psychiatry does not have any real, actual evidence for anything that it suggests existing. This is why it is such a problem that there is no blood test, there is no brain scan, there is no genetic anything. There is no evidence of any of this existing other than somebody's subjective determination that somebody has something. And I love the way this article writes, quote, feels bipolar to me. And so I think it's really important to know that there are a lot of different people who are speaking out against what Murphy is pushing here, and how it goes forward. This author does say, in reference to involuntary outpatient commitment, assisted outpatient treatment, that, quote, AOT is old news, except New York, which pours millions of dollars into it, basically lies fallow. It costs too much and does too little for too few. In New York, it serves 1/3 of 1%. To pass it off as an essential piece of reform in a system needing widespread is at best a distortion and at worst a lie, and it is reprehensible. And so I think that, you know, coming from New York, I do have a different perspective than maybe people in other parts of the country that aren't exposed to these kinds of things, that aren't living in a system where at least $32 million tax dollars a year is being spent on involuntary outpatient commitment. That's what's going on in New York State, at least $32 million a year, and with ever expansions, the new... you know, what was just passed in the Senate to close the quote-unquote loophole because of the man who stabbed the two children, heinous, horrible act that never should have occurred, that is tragic, that is horrible. But still, the idea that now every person who's in jail or prison is also going to be screened for whether or not they meet the criteria for Kendra's law because of that, it's another whole group that a net has been cast over in order to further meet the agenda of social control through psychiatry. And, you know, I don't think anybody is quite that honest about it, but that is, on many degrees, what is happening. So, you know, one of the things that Murphy is fighting is that people are, quote, dying with their rights on. And yet he also talks about that too many of his patients died. Last night I said that this was discussed on the Diane Rehm show, and I was absolutely wrong. This was actually discussed with Laura Sullivan on All Things Considered on NPR, May 29th and 30th it aired. And so I'm going to just play a little clip of some of the video that I've been floating around all day of Murphy talking about this, but I want you to... see this and see that there's the immediate association of the violence by associating Adam Lanza with anybody who has a psychiatric history, which is ludicrous and irresponsible, and people who are doing this kind of thing that leads to psychiatric profiling ought to be held accountable. But then Murphy makes a statement that too many of his own patients have died, and so I'm very curious about what this is about. And so I actually called over to his home base office today and was told that his press secretary would get back to me, but that has yet to happen, so we'll see. But here is Murphy talking on NPR, and it's a little bit mixed, and you know, I did take a little creative flair with this, so bear with if it's a little too much, but let's see if this works.
Knows to do something. Because Adam Lanza and Roland and the other people who have nowhere to go, who have not gotten a diagnosis, who have not gotten treatment, who have not gotten a diagnosis, are out there dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? Women who have not gotten a diagnosis, dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? I have seen too many of my patients die. Adam Lanza's role and the other people who have nowhere to go, who have not gotten treatment, who have not gotten a diagnosis, dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? I have seen too many of my patients die.
So, there you go. The Adam Lanzas and the other people of the world who have not gotten treatment, not gotten a diagnosis. So what are we really talking about here? Because from the Murphy bill, you would think that they were talking about people who had psychiatric histories. Oh, no, no, no. But they're not. This is the part of this goal is to have everybody identified, screened, treated. And I think this becomes one of the dangers of where mixing the Barber bill into this, 4574. H.R. 4574, that this becomes super dangerous because the Barber bill is all about early identification and screening and treatment. And goes after young people, young adults, and veterans. So if either H.R. 3717, the Murphy bill, the Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act, and again, helping families, not helping people, helping families, if that passes, or if some version of the Murphy bill and the Barber bill merged pass, either way, as a society, we are going to be in dear trouble. And you know, this idea of Murphy putting right out there that he thinks that people are dying with their rights on, and it's like, well, you know, that's absolutely such an abusive way of positioning the human rights movement, and such a disacknowledgement of the torture and abuse that people are subjected to under psychiatry. And, you know, so what do you do with the quote-unquote sickest of people, the people who are, so why is there this assumption that psychiatry has an answer for this? Because psychiatry has not had an answer for this for the longest period of time. I'm just going to play this little clip again here, and there's a bunch of people online, and if any of you would like to join in the conversation, please press star 1 or 1, I'm not sure which it is, depending on which line you called in on, to let me know. But remember, this is people dying with their rights on.
I was going to do something. Because Adam Lanza's role and the other people who have nowhere to go, who have not gotten a diagnosis, are out there dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? Women who have not gotten a diagnosis, dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? I have seen too many.
Code 202, your line is open.
You know, Father, we keep trying to forget that people do have the right to have their own destiny, and we can't prevent bad things from happening all the time. And as horrible as it is, I can say this, to lose somebody because they've taken their life, even when someone says, well, someone says that they're going to kill themselves and I'm going to call help to come get them. That sometimes only delays something. And I'm saying this as a person who has been suicidal myself, Lauren, that, you know, these feelings that people have around taking their own life, they don't go away simply because you go and talk to someone or someone gives you a pill for a few days. They last for quite a long time until you work out some other things.
I was going to say, I'll go one further. They don't go away because you reject psychiatry. You know, as somebody who has battled with these kinds of things myself, just because I refuse to participate in psychiatry doesn't mean that these kinds of feelings go away. And I think that, you know, when you look at what others like Carl Jung talked about, that the to experience the other side of the dark side of you know, is part of nature, that this is to, and the idea of drugging these kinds of things away, or that people will you know, that it's such a problem. But I don't think that Murphy is limiting this to people who are contemplating taking their lives. And if there is anybody out there who is in this kind of situation, please know that there are alternatives. There's ways to push through. You're not alone inside of this. As painful and hard as it is, there are people who are like-minded who you can connect with, and even just, you know, calling in here if you wanted to. But there are other ways. Every time we talk about this, I feel like it's necessary. I'm no proponent of suicide. And sometimes people.
And we're not trying to. I don't think.
Sometimes people
encouraged.
Confuse.
People know that there's a lot of times what happens. People sometimes feel hopeless, and if you say that you're going to hurt yourself to sometimes to get attention, it ends the conversation.
Well, I mean, not only sometimes to get attention. I don't want to limit it to sometimes to get attention. Sometimes because that's what somebody wants to do, and I think that we need to also remember, like,
no,
the common response.
But in other words, you really do feel hopeless. Not saying, because sometimes people say, "Oh, just saying this because they want to." It's not.
I see. Sorry.
When you feel very hopeless like this, and you want to communicate with other people, and what I'm saying is that many people go directly to, oh, my God, they want to do away with themselves. Let me call someone else in instead of what the person has. What needs is people to talk to. I mean, you know, you have it's typical of, not typical, but sometimes a few family members will do this. You know, they may not be engaged with their family member on a day-to-day basis, and if something like that comes up, they automatically rush to improve psychiatry. I say this one thing about myself. When you have plans for the future, it's hard to kill yourself. If you have someone that you know who has these kind of feelings, it's hard for them to do it if they have things to look forward to. So what I'm saying is not that you'll have an answer, but you can't take responsibility for another person. Even if you have known someone, and I've known people that have taken their own life, and I'm just saying that you can't prevent it. You know, you can't prevent it in all cases.
It's a choice, but there are things that people can do to assist, and that's a whole other conversation, but I do think that for anybody who may be in that period, and others have called where they've talked about, you know, that this doesn't go away just because, you know, you've resolved on some level something, doesn't mean that this goes away, and that this is part of a lived experience, and that it's okay, and that it's okay to have these feelings, and that you don't need to be locked up because you're having these feelings, because it's a feeling, and like other feelings, it comes and it goes, and there are ways to mediate it. But I do think that you're right, that having things that you know, even just plans to do something with somebody,
and not being a victim. You know, making yourself the hero of your own story is very important. I mean, getting up and fighting and not being a doormat really helps. And there are people out here who may be listening to who have lost other people. And I have to say that it's a very painful thing. I'm just saying this because we never know who's on the line that's listening to us. It's a very painful thing when someone takes their life, and how you when you do something like that, how it affects other people that you that supposedly love you, and other people who think that they love people, but they rush right away instead of saying, well, you know, can you hold off until this to tomorrow, till we meet for breakfast or lunch or something like this. And I'm not trying to say I'm an expert on this, but for my own self, I'm just saying this because we don't know who's on the line. I say suicide is a permanent resolution to oftentimes temporary problems. And the people that are around us can do a lot to help people delay. I have to say this. I used to have suicidal and homicidal feelings quite a bit. And for me, they did kind of go away because I found another way to channel my anger instead of to myself. And a lot of times people, when they're feeling suicidal, it's because there are things that are happening to us that we don't have control over. There's pain that's involved there. You know, it takes a great deal of a sensation when you have that much pain that you want to take yourself out. And there's no amount of medication, there's no amount of intervention that will overnight make that go away.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think that it's important to interject here, you know, because I've been reading from Larry Drain's article tonight, and so in like the third paragraph, he writes, my sister-in-law was, according to your terms, quote, severely mentally ill. She took her life 14 years ago, but the illness didn't kill her. The treatment did. She was taking so many meds, she had meds for her meds. She couldn't think a clear thought. She told me she was lost. Then she told me there was nothing left to find. Then she died. That was reprehensible. And I think that people need to be aware. I mean, that the drugs don't make it go away, and being anti-psychiatry doesn't make it go away.
I can attest to that. The drugs, some of the chemicals can make you feel suicidal.
And to be aware of that. I mean, and I've talked about this publicly, you know, for many years, but the first time that I ever, you know, had the idea or took a very, you know, childish attempt at taking my life was when I was 7 years old. And so, you know, therefore the childish attempt, right? And I think that these things, that when people are going through different kinds of experiences, experiencing trauma, experiencing pain, experiencing loss, feeling an overwhelming inability to control their own lives, that it seems like an answer, but it's really not. But also then when you add in these drugs that have a known side, it's not a side effect, it's a part of what the drug does, is causes you to become suicidal or homicidal, to be aware of that. And to you know, really question out in your mind, is this me or is this drug that I'm on? And if you're not on any drugs, to really start questioning out, what can I do differently? Who can I connect with differently, right? Because very often if all you've got around you is people who are causing you to, or your response to them is that it's making you want to take your own life, perhaps being around other people prior to doing that is part of the solution.
And being around positive people, because sometimes people think it's positive. I had a personal message from someone, and they said they went to a conference, and they felt so down because people were saying, you need to hurry up and get your loved one into long-term care. And to go to church. And sometimes some of these things that people are telling people, these messages, are hopelessness, are further hopelessness. If you're telling me that the only thing that I have to look forward to is to eat, sleep, and take prescriptions, That's hopeless. That's hopelessness that you're compounding on that person, that you're making them feel even more hopeless than what they already ready do. I want to point out before you go on further, can I do this, that Larry's his blog is at hopeworkscommunity.wordpress.com. And Larry Drain is out of Knoxville, Tennessee. And that was the reference that Lauren was making earlier
right.
to Larry Drain's log at hopeworkscommunity.com. So people might
right.
want to
that
check
was
it out.
The short URL that I spelled out before. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the full one.
I didn't do that.
Yeah, and I think that there's this, you know, this misconception by psychiatry that what they're offering. I mean, I distinctly remember when I got locked up for the first time when I was 15, and really like kind of done with, you know, existing at that point. I really remember very clearly, like, how is this supposed to make me want to be alive? How is locking me up in an institution and throwing me in a seclusion room and putting me on one-to-one and dehumanizing me and taking all of my things away from me and preventing me from being able to contact my friends, and like, how in any way is this like the proper solution to somebody who wants to end their life, and why are we treating people this way?
And what makes you want to do it more? I mean, when that might make you want to do it more. If this is what it comes to, you know, to be locked up like an animal, you know, sometimes people they don't see the messages that they're sending to young people, that they're sending to people, you know, it's
to any people. Yeah, I mean, and I think that, you know, the way that this gets all mixed up in social terms, and how quickly everybody you know, jumps, not everybody, but how quickly the media and the legislators jump toward you know, putting more restrictive kinds of experiences for people, and then you know, it's you know, and taking away their lives and their hope. I think, you know, there's a another great point that Larry made in his article. Over 60% of people with a mental health diagnosis, he writes, in my state are unemployed. In some states, it goes over 90%. It's a result of a systematic discrimination against labeled people. That is reprehensible. Never, not once, have I ever heard you address that to Murphy. He writes, without a job, you don't tend to have insurance. You're more likely to become homeless. Your family is more likely to suffer. And it's not just on economic terms. When people are told that they can't work, that they can't have a future, that they can't have dreams, that they can't contribute, what makes somebody who is being given this message want to? If you're told that you can't, and you're on these drugs that are brainwashing you and that are making it easy for you to believe whatever it is that you're being told, we're losing huge portions of our citizenship here, of community, of people who can be contributing, and who are then left to feel like they're less than and that they can't do anything that they want to be doing.
That's a typical person who has submitted. I say submission. Submitted, and I'm not saying in a bad way. It's because people, you go to your doctor, your brother, your sister, your family member, and they say, you need to get into long-term treatment. You need to apply for Social Security. Let's talk about the people who are part of that epidemic that Rich Whitaker talks about. I mean, typically the person is getting a subsidy of probably less than $1,000. On SSI, I can't remember what the amount is, but it's somewhere under $800, and somebody can correct me. And then you get a message, oh, you better not try to work. because you'll lose that, you know, subsidy that you're getting, and you'll lose that Medicaid that will keep you, help keep you to see the doctor and get the medication. And if you do some deep thinking about those things, you say, well, what is your life like? If you, it means perpetual poverty. It means that you're probably either you're not living on your own, or if you are, you have to have some kind of voucher subsidy from the government, or you're living with parents, or you're living in some kind of group identity. Now, what, I mean, group identity meaning that some kind of supervised housing. Now, how can you feel very hopeful in that kind of situation?
Right, because it's hope that what keeps people hanging on. And on every level, hope is taken away from people, and the debasement that comes from why, as a society, are we those who are in the most need of assistance, people with disability, why are we having them exist at a level below poverty? And Larry Drain writes about this. He says, you preach about the plight of the, quote, mentally ill in the jail, but you never talk about the factors like poverty, drug addiction, trauma, gang involvement, racism, and others that lead to criminal behavior. Largely, your party is against any legislation that would affect any of those factors. That is reprehensible. And this idea of poverty, and what we consider as a society, what we're considering assistance to people, it really is reprehensible.
And it keeps people from having a normal, not to use the word normal, familiar relationships. People don't get married because if I get married, I'll lose my SSI. I mean, Larry Drain is an excellent example of a person who worked and retired early, and he found out that by him doing that, he was going to cause his wife of, I can't remember, 27 or 37 years, not to have medical insurance. They actually separated. They're separated so that she can get Medicaid. She has seizures, and it's actually life-threatening.
It's the same way if people who are living with public assistance are prevented from being able to get married, right? It's the same kind of thing of, like, let's keep people down. Let's stop these kinds of relationships from occurring. Let's stop people being able to develop strong supportive networks that will be long lasting and permanent. Let's keep everybody at bay and prevent them from getting the things that we get. I mean, I saw on the news the other day that, like, the 1%, I mean, and you know, well, here we are again, like 37% of the United States' money is owned by the 1% now. Like, it's jumped. Like, post-Occupy, it's actually gone higher.
Well, the wealthy get wealthier. And that's why people like Warren Buffett have a giving program where they're encouraging billionaires to give their money away. There's a difference between being rich and being wealthy. Wealthy means you have to have you have so much money that you have to have a plan of giving to give it away while other people are hungry. I remember my son, he was about 15 years old. He didn't really understand this, and I thought it was a testament to me. He didn't understand that people had to pay to buy groceries. He said, "Why do people have to pay to eat? That's, you know, something that they shouldn't have to do." This has been one of the reasons why some people said that they did not want affordable health care, because they said if people had affordable health care, they wouldn't work. But
not that it wouldn't work.
Most of those states are southern states, in the six to seven, I can't remember that, and don't quote me on it, six or seven states which didn't expand Medicaid for affordable health care in those states where many of those people are pro-Murphy, who say that they want to have the Tim Murphy bill passed. And the reality is, in most places, Medicaid pays for mental health. They did not expand it. So the only way that people who are in those states will get some kind of emotional health care is through, coercion or through court-ordered treatment, because in some places, like in the state of Virginia, I believe the amount to qualify for Medicaid, you have to be 80% below poverty level. Places
right.
like Arizona, it's, you know, like ridiculous amount. I mean,
right.
you just
and,
really have to be. So, you know, this,
yeah,
this
I mean,
hopelessness.
And Larry, yeah, I mean, I just want to, before you, and it is, it builds the hopelessness. It multiplies, it grows it at fanatical rates. The economic devastation. There's no way it can't. But in Larry Drain wrote, I live in a state that has over 8,000 people with mental health issues without insurance because they have chosen not to expand Medicaid. That is reprehensible. And it is totally reprehensible that you have voted over 50 times against the ACA while claiming to be an advocate for the very people you would deny medical coverage for. People with
That's
quote,
what I don't understand about Murphy is how is he proponent to be a proponent for that unless everybody is going to be adjudicated through the court that wants, because there are more people that are standing in line to get appointments with psychiatry or social work that can't get them. And they want to front end load it with people who are your neighbors and your estranged spouse is going to put you before the court. So it's really very very sick. They're going to put a strain. I don't understand how states like Tennessee, Mississippi, and places like that, how their legislators who are in Congress, how they can actually support these things. And at the same time, they don't have Medicaid expansion to back up the care that they have for the people that are supposedly the most disabled. If you believe that mental illness is real and people are crippled by it, then that means that they don't have the economic wherewithal to have a job. In this country, most of the time, the way that people get health care is through their employer. So it's a great contradiction that somebody Murphy is against affordable health care, but at the same time, he's pushing for mandated judicial care. I shouldn't say care, intervention for people. It's such a great contradiction. I just really don't understand it. And that's why I say, some people say, well, you know, the people like Murphy and some other people, they really believe that. And I said, well, they're truly evil or misguided.
They don't believe this. They don't believe this. They're riding in on our backs. That's all they're doing. They are using us to target out, create more funding streams, create further social control amongst people. These people don't care about whether or not people are. If they cared, they would look at the evidence that says that psychiatry kills people. They would look at the evidence that says that, like, people benefit greatly from alternatives. They don't care about any of this. And, you know, and Larry writes, people with, quote, mental illness die years earlier than those without. 25 to 30 years, according to the NASHBID study, as far as I'm aware. And then he continues, they by and large get lousy medical care. They get, quote, cured by medicines that for some have life-altering consequences. That is reprehensible. This is that they are killing people. Metabolic syndrome, diabetes, kidney, liver damage, tardive dyskinesia, neurolytic malignant syndrome. The list goes on and on and on. Who knows what we're doing? And then when we're doing this to young people and putting young people on these drugs, who knows what we are doing to anybody? And Murphy has the audacity to sit there and say people are dying with their rights on.
He wants to squelch the drawing of attention to just the things that you've been saying.
And I want to play it again.
Call in 267-521-0167. Did you see that in the United Kingdom? They're making
Before we switch, I have a couple other things that I wanted to just make sure that I mentioned. And because there's a bunch of people listening now that weren't listening before, and hi everybody who's online or listening through the internet who I have no idea. But those who I can see your numbers online, hi, I hope all is good. I want to play this clip again because I think people just need to hear it and need to know that this is what Murphy is talking about. This grouping of the conditioning of society to associate violence with things that are so quote unquote psychiatric, and then the audacity to say that people are dying with their rights on because what all these poor people, and then that he has had patients. He says, I have seen too many of my patients die. I want to know what patients of his died and why. He brought it out. I want to know why. And here's the clip again.
I was going to do something. Because Adam Lanza and the other people who have nowhere to go, who have not gotten treatment, who have not gotten a diagnosis, are out there dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? Who have not gotten a diagnosis. Dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? I have seen too many of my patients die. Adam Lanza and the other people who have nowhere to go, who have not gotten treatment, who have not gotten a diagnosis, dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? I have seen too many of my patients die.
So, this is no joke. He's talking people who haven't gotten treatment, who haven't gotten a diagnosis. This law, H.R. 3717, is to get every single American diagnosed and on some kind of drug or in some position of social control or provide employment for those who are doing it. We are clearly divided into two groups at this point, those who have been diagnosed, those who are about to be diagnosed, and those who are diagnosing, and the assignment of people, and that what is reprehensible that spurred Larry's whole writing here, if I'm right, and Larry, if I'm wrong, please correct me, but what's reprehensible is this idea that people, that you say it is morally reprehensible for anyone to help a patient question the medical advice a professional gives him. And that is what spurred all of this. And I just want to make sure that I mention that that there have been postings and responses on Larry's thing that I have permission to talk about from one person. And if I can just get there on the thing, of course, my computer just bowed out. Here we go. It is also reprehensible, Maxine writes, that Representative Murphy and his legislative supporters ethically, morally, and professionally seem to be omitting knowledge and review of the extensive investigations. Maxine writes, quote, findings of the U.S. Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, Special Litigation Unit, Cases and Matters, for examples, heading Disability Rights Docket, California, findings letters. The significant, quote, failures of the severely broken MH system of care indicated by the findings, even in the extremely controlled state hospital settings, are as prevalent in the outpatient settings nationwide. And so that there are pages of failings, and Maxine has shared that, and I'm going to just also share that on my page for people. But I want people to know that there's a huge conversation going on here. And if you're not in the conversation and want to be, now is the time to join and to start speaking out, because we are losing this. If these bills or some version of the Barber and Murphy bill pass, if this all winds up going forward, we are just as a society devastated. There is going to be very very little hope about this, and that people are going to be further discriminated against.
Contrarily, people just think that I have that same thing that Murphy was accusing in that little diatribe that he had. I've been accused of that too. Say, Vaughn, well, what do you want? You want people to be homeless? You know, what do you want them to be? We're going to, you're going to write them out right out to the street.
And it's just, and I think that people should go read, Larry's article in entirety. But, here's where it winds down. That he writes, Larry writes, you preach against the mental health system and paint SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. For those of you who don't know, that's the federal government, a federal government's arm for administering mental health and substance abuse services and creating federal regulation and such, and funding. So Larry writes, SAMHSA, as the source of all things bad. You ignore the fact that mental health systems are state creations, but while in one breath you slam the mental health system as being ineffective and almost criminal, in the next breath you advocate for a bill that would force people to receive services from the same system you say is useless. You can't have it both ways. To try to smack of political opportunism and outright fraud, and all of this is way past reprehensible, Larry Dreen writes. I mean, this is just such an excellent article, and people should go to HopeWorks Community and check it out, and other articles that he's written in the past also, I think, really deserve attention.
Are really aware of the fact that how arbitrary these things can be, because people seem to, I think some people seem to feel like they're talking about somebody other than me. And what it is. They're not talking about me. They're talking about, that guy that, walked up and down the street talking to himself. They're not talking about me. And they are talking about you, because the DSM-5 is so designed that almost any measure of human behavior can be seen as a label. And the United Kingdom, they call it people being sectioned.
Right.
So
that
can be sectioned to a part of the DSM-5. There's no way.
Right. In Canada, in Canada too, and other places. Yeah, and that's like, you could do any Foucault loving people out there. This would be right up Foucault's alley in terms of the other and how we are, literally carved out of society. And you can't carve us out of society, as Joe Fander said in the D-Voice videos, like, we're like one human body, and you can't carve a piece of us out because you don't like us and put us over there. Like, that doesn't work. Before we move to the United Kingdom, I just want to also make sure that I mention this, because it's really important that people realize that if H.R. 3717 and 4574, if the Murphy and Barber bills emerged, there's going to be a further effort to go after young people, young adults, and veterans. And what's happening to our young people, we've talked about, but what's happening to our veterans as often as possible, I want people to just keep on remembering and speaking out and acting on behalf of these women and men who have gone to war for us, seen and had to experience things that most of us will never, ever understand, including myself, and couldn't even really fathom, and then come back and say that they are now, quote-unquote, mentally ill and need to be drugged and electroshocked and have implants put into their brains and all other kinds of who knows what else, and have their, their rights stripped away from
them. With Department of Justice, with the court system. So, I don't understand why, for example, some people in the Black Caucus are not up in arms about this, because it, the potential here is that any kind of police action against a person can be justified by scouring their past history, their computer, or whatever else, say that they have a mental illness, there's or some kind of whether it's postpartum depression, whether it's whatever that you have. No one can escape the way that they have this DSM-5 written. And so any kind of action against, police action against you, the police can actually use that as justification for their force. You know, there's been many instances across the country where people have actually died in police custody. And somehow when people are identified as having a label or they may have had some undiagnosable history, all of a sudden it becomes sort of justified because we've coupled the criminal justice, the courts, we've made so that people with labels equal dangerousness. So it really puts everybody at risk to have this kind of broad sweeping way. And as you said, what's happened to our veterans, I was just noting that at the NAMI conference is going to be in Washington, D.C., and I'm not they're going to have a judge.
And you're not promoting it, right?
I'm not promoting it, but they're having a judge to speak who has a veteran court. Now, people think that we're strange by saying that, but they're having veteran courts.
The Veterans Courts, yeah, and it's built into H.R. 3717, and there's all kinds of where they're putting all in one place criminal, mental health, substance abuse, and they're calling it Veterans Courts. And so people really need to watch out about that, same as with mental health courts.
Why is it people don't see that something is, the speaker is Judge Robert Russell, that you should see something that's wrong with that. What's wrong with that? When someone serves their country, they go away, they get injured, and I don't like post-traumatic stress. I don't like any of it, but I would prefer to say post-traumatic injury. And then you come back and you find out that you have a veterans treatment court, which diverts eligible veteran defendants with substance dependency and or mental illness to a specialized criminal court. Now I'm reading from this document, where they voluntarily participate in a judicially supervised treatment plan. Voluntarily participate. Now you know that's not voluntary. They say you can either do this or you can go to jail. That's what that's
right.
That's
and,
how.
And if you don't comply. Right, and if you don't comply with either, like you go in and you're having some kind of, you know, you're having a response. I like that you were injured in this. You had to witness and be part of war. The thing that is one of the most just I can't even imagine. Right. So and then so you come back and now you're told that because you're in this veterans court, something happens, whatever, you wind up in veterans court. And then you're told that you have to now have random urine analysis, and if they find alcohol in your urine, then you go to jail. But you don't have any kind of issue with alcohol, and even if you did, who's you know to say? And now that's it. If you went in because you were struggling with drugs, painkillers that we know that, like, there's, like, a 300% rise in deaths of veterans from painkillers and the cocktails that they're being put on. Like, how now they say, well, your issue is really that this sparks some kind of, quote-unquote, psychosis, and you now need to be on this antipsychotic drug. And we're gonna, we're gonna test you for it. And if your levels aren't correct, then we're gonna start injecting you with it. And so you better take it. Otherwise, you're gonna wind up going to jail, where you'll get it there too.
And the history hasn't been too good. I mean, I haven't felt too good about CBS since they had, he who cannot be named as a supposedly authority on the leading authority on mental illness, but they did have a good story on how veterans who were in the VA system were having overdoses, not because they took medications against advice, because they took medications, painkillers, and psychiatric as prescribed, and they were dying.
And they are dying, and we're killing them on purpose, and that's one of the reasons why, like, on Memorial Day, it was remembering all of the veterans who have been killed by psychiatry, and how many more, and what they're willing to do to them. And I just want to mention that the DOJ report that Maxine was referring to, which I posted up on my wall, says that the findings of this report include misdiagnosis, over-medication, that these are findings of fact, that these are not opinion. And so when anybody starts talking about, respect my opinion, I can't respect your opinion if it's based not on fact. And that psychiatry has successfully confused fact and opinion. And that what we have of facts is that there's no evidence for any psychiatric label. And what we have as opinion is that thinking it's biological is opinion. That is not fact. And that they can get away with this.
You forget there's a wizard in the room. If a person has at least four initials behind their name, whatever they say becomes a fact.
Well, I have, let's see, 3, 6, 9. I think I have 12 plus psychiatric survivor.
Yeah, but what is happening is people are saying that I had someone in one of my groups. I had posted that story, and I want to continue with the vets before we get to the United Kingdom. I posted that story about the United Kingdom that we'll get to later on one of my. Websites, and someone said something about it being divisive. They later on came back and said they really didn't mean that. But I'm gonna quote this because sometimes you have to say things exactly the way people say them so that people can hear it. Let's see. I do believe we need a paradigm shift, but I don't think you can sweep a broad brush on either side of the issue. For me, there's no doubt in my mind that my illness, and I believe I have one, is mostly biochemical. That does mean that for me or anyone, that the only path to recovery is medical. Everyone has to come to their own truth on this divisive issue. And I kind of put this in there. This is not an attempt to
begin. Where are you reading from? Because I'm just a little lost.
I'm reading from a post after I posted this information about how the British Psychological Society is saying that there's no evidence of mental illness either. And,
okay, I just
someone,
don't know which post you're talking. Yeah, I don't. I lost track as to which. Post you
okay.
were talking about,
so,
but I get the general gist of it.
The same thing you're saying we should have discussions. And my reply was, this is not an attempt to be divisive. NIMH is saying much of the same thing. This is not to say people have not are not having real emotional distress. And I think that that's what some people are saying when we say that there's no evidence of mental illness. Many people have been led to or think that we're trying to say that what they've been through is not really an emotional
distress. Oh, I'm
never
saying that. I mean, and I maybe I don't say that I'm never saying that enough, but I'm never saying that. I'm just saying that that it's exactly because of what we've been through, not because of some broken brain disease model. You know, like that's all I'm saying.
For the purpose of this, I did not mean to imply criticism. But you know that people do have strong views on that. You know, when people say it's biochemical, you know, quickly you say, well, where's the blood test? Where's the X-ray? You know, are you getting periodic brain scans to show whether your condition is improving or not? And when you ask them, the people come up empty. And,
I mean, the other side is that the responses are always, you know, drugs or horrifying, horrible kinds of dehumanizing places and things that we're subjected to, and the just the psychological way that we're treated, as if we're less than human, is part of the problem. And so,
I think more and more people across the world are coming to see that that there's no scientific evidence of psychiatric diagnosis. And this is what this, as I had posted, I think I sent it to you too, that the British Psychological Society is to launch an attack on rival profession, casting doubt on biomedical models of mental illness. And isn't this the same profession that Murphy belongs to?
Well, Murphy's a psychologist.
Well,
so psychology and psychiatry are somewhat different, although these days they're hard to tell apart. But in certainly in the roots, psychology and psychiatry are different.
The British Psychological Society is supposed to be the one to launch this. The Guardian, the Observer.
Why am I not? I'm not seeing this post. I keep looking for it, but I can't find it anywhere.
I wanna let me flip it to you now.
Okay.
I think the best way for me to do that.
If people want to call in and talk, it's area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, the number to call is area code 855-346-3351. It's 855-346-3351. And just a reminder to all of you people who are hanging out online listening on the phone, press 1 or star 1 in order to contact in and let me know that you'd like to talk, if you'd like to join in the conversation. I think it's really important that we continue to speak out and to debunk the misinformation that is being put out by psychiatry, and there's so much of it. But, you know, just again, for those of you who may not know me, I forget sometimes that people don't know me. I'm really not against drugs. I have no problem with people. I think people should be able to do whatever drugs they want. So this isn't about even the quote-unquote drugs for me. This is about the way people are made to feel about themselves and how we limit ourselves based on the messaging that we're given by these people. I need to say this, because if this is some of like the concerns that people have about what I'm saying, I really want people to understand that if somebody was to walk into my house right now, they would lock me up and say that I'm not able to live on my own. Do you know what I mean? I appreciate the daily struggle. I just need to really make people understand this. I appreciate the daily struggle more than probably just about anybody else in the world. I am unable to wake up and go to sleep every day. I have a completely irrational, non-24 sleep cycle. I have all kinds of physical problems that cause me to, you know, not be able to get around in the way that I need to. I have a service dog, and I've had a service dog since 2003, and two different dogs. And so I'm never, ever, ever suggesting that people aren't having real experiences when I say there's no biomedical, the medical model is inappropriate to this. I'm saying that there is no evidence of things like quote-unquote schizophrenia or quote-unquote any of these things that exist, and that I'm not the only one saying this, that there have been plenty of people for decades, doctors and advocates and activists and psychologists and psychiatrists who have been saying that the medical model is a fraud, and that part of why I'm so outspoken about it is because I believed it, and had I believed them, A, I would probably be dead by now, and if I continued to believe them, I'd probably be dead by now, or I'd be locked up in some institution somewhere, you know, constantly being put into restraints and chemically restrained and probably electroshocked by now and every other friggin' thing. So, and that's why I'm so as passionate about it as I am, because if I had continued to buy into it, that would have been the life that I had in the future. And so I just want to, like, make that, I don't know how else to make it clear that that's where I'm coming from, but that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I hear you, Lauren, and, I'm glad that you're saying that, because we have to repeat that. I have to repeat that to people that, you know, people are not saying that people don't have, they have really haven't had pain. They really haven't had suffering.
I
hear you. And we're not, we're saying that people really had it, but some of that is related to trauma, it's related to things, it's related to different things, and,
right, and
there's no way that you can there's no way to pick who is going to be in emotional distress.
Right,
there's
and
no
I just
way.
Want to say area code 865 is on, but it's not even about predicting who's going to be in emotional quote-unquote distress. Even if you could predict it, psychiatry doesn't have any natural answers for it outside of drugs, which there are plenty of ways to do these days. Area code 865, your line is open.
Hi, my name is Larry Drain.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, I'm glad to be on your show. I've been listening to it, and I appreciate you reading my stuff.
Well, I appreciate you writing it, and thanks, and I hope that I read it with okay inflection. I'm just wondering, thanks so much for calling in. Is there something specific you'd like to talk about, or things that you would like people to know about why you're doing what you're doing, or anything?
I think it has a lot to do with, you know, I think I heard you say something about that when Representative Murphy said that telling somebody not to listen to medical advice, that was reprehensible. That is where a lot of it started for me, with things in particular that my wife was told that if she had listened to or if we had followed would have ended up killing her. And just, you know, the whole stuff about the Murphy bill, that it truly is a fraud, that even if you accept every single thing that they said is true, it's still a fraud. You know, the AOT in 45 states basically lies empty. The only state that I know of that uses it to any degree at all is New York, and they put a lot of money into it, and even with all the money and all the everything that they put into it, they have 1/3 of 1% of the population in AOT, and how in the world anybody can seriously say that is a reform of the mental health system just baffles me. It baffles me how... You know,
$32 million at least, as a New Yorker, I know this real well.
And,
so it's
know,
at least $32 million
yeah,
a year.
And I live in Tennessee, and in Tennessee there's not going to be, I mean, they can make a law, but nobody in Tennessee really buys it. You know, they actually tried to get a pilot program going. They put aside, I think, something like $100,000 for it or something like that. And after 1 year, it had served one person. And that one, the money that was spent on that could have went to so many other places that did so well. You know, I'm disturbed by the emphasis on psychiatric hospitalization. I think that's also a fraud. I think the ship on psychiatric hospitalization sailed a long, 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 long time ago. It costs too much money. It doesn't work. It does more harm than good. And testimony of person after person after person tells you that. But again, I know in Tennessee, there's not going to be any new psychiatric beds because, you know, the state is struggling financially. It's just not going to happen. And for Representative Murphy and for, you know, Dr. Torrey and whoever else is throwing out all this nonsense to say it with a straight face, like they're going to change things. None of these things change anything because none of them are going to make any kind of a difference. They're not going to have any less people in jail. You know, most of the people I know are poor people, and most of the people I know that are involved in criminal kinds of things are poor people. And, you know, if you don't do something about the conditions of people's lives, You can't give them a pill to make it go away. So, I mean, there's just so many things. And I, in my great distress is that there's so many people in need of, you know, who have true, honest to good distress in life that fall between the cracks of the system or that live in the cracks of the system or that are hurt more by the system that's supposed to serve them. And there are real changes that need to be made. And to have someone stand up and say, you know, this is a real change, when it's not a real change, it's a political agenda driven by, you know, my opinion for a long time since it first came out, it's basically been that Dr. Tory's AOT fell on its rear in every single state. It costs too much money. It does too little for too few. And he got tired of talking to the state, so he decided to try to make it a federal law. And, you know, that it's about power, that it's about influence, that it's about all these kinds of things. And it's just wrong. It's just simply wrong. And it's all reprehensible. It is an injury to people who have already been injured, who have already been hurt by life. You know, I think we live in a system that too often, you know, many of the people I know tell me, you know, I had a friend call me one night about 3 o'clock in the morning, and she told me that she was suicidal and that she didn't want to die. And if she asked me, you know, about going to the ER, and I said, well, you know, maybe you should go to the ER. And finally she stopped and she said, you know, I'm not going to do that. She said, if I go there, they're going to put me in the state hospital. I've already been in the state hospital, and I'd rather die than go there. And I hear stuff like that from so many people who view the system that's supposed to help them as being as hurtful as the distress that they deal with. You know, and I think it's way past time to do things that actually help the people that are supposed to be helped. You know, I heard Yvonne talking about my situation. You know, it's not so much a mental health situation, but I'm also in a position where the system that is supposed to help has hurt. I've been in a situation where to keep my wife alive, we have to separate after 33 years of marriage. And that's what I have to do to keep her alive. And it's just a crazy law. It has to do with Medicaid expansion and a lot of other things. But, you know, it's time for the system that's supposed to help people not be the greatest threat in their life. And I think right now, for many, many people, in many, many ways, the system is the greatest threat in their life.
Well, Larry, there's one thing that also that we had a discussion about this, I think, a couple of months ago, is that people don't take these things piece by piece. It's just like when he talks about expansion of Medicaid into state hospital beds. The thing about it is, like you said, the train has left the station. There are no more of these hospital beds, and Medicaid billing does not give you brick and mortar. You have to have brick and mortar spaces.
Like in Tennessee, even if they say that Medicaid reimbursement is available, it's still not going to do anything. You know, they don't reimburse enough to pay for the beds. They don't reimburse enough to build the buildings. They don't pay enough to staff the staff. And it's just a fraud. It's just a something where people can say, hey, I'm doing something meaningful, when they're not doing anything meaningful at all.
They're not doing anything meaningful because also a long time ago, decades ago, mental health, whether you believe that it's a fraud or not, was advocated to the Medicaid system. And people like Murphy that are against Medicaid expansion, really against people getting mental health help, those who believe that the system can help them. That's what it is. And even if many of these distresses that people have are caused by real physical problems. If you have real physical problems, you are going to be under emotional distress. If you're in
My wife has been epileptic since birth. 10 years ago, a good day for her was 15 grand mal seizures, and most days were not good days. They finally told her that she would have to have a brain operation or she would die. So she had the brain operation, and for a short period of time, the seizures went away, but then they came back again. And then what she also found was she had a whole host of disabilities that she didn't have before then. Well, about 8 years ago, she was labeled as having bipolar disorder. Well, in the last year, we've been to the emergency room a gazillion times, and she's basically been told everything is in her head. She's got a red mark next to her that says mental health patient, and no doctor ever took her serious. Well, in the last week, in the last 2 weeks, we have found out there is something seriously physically wrong that should have been found a year ago, but because she has a mental health diagnosis, no doctor ever took her serious.
Right.
How can the emergency room alone?
Many of not saying you shouldn't, but many people need not to go to the emergency room alone, so they can be taken seriously.
And I'm just wondering, how can a state that is so seemingly progressive about not having institutions and not having support for involuntary outpatient commitment or any of that, be so backwards in the discrimination toward people who are psychiatrically labeled? Like, it's like a disconnect to me.
There's a lot of things that are totally bizarre. You know, in many ways, Tennessee has a lot of of all the states that I have any knowledge of whatsoever, the Treatment Advocacy Center has less influence in Tennessee than anywhere. They're not welcome. People don't talk to them. People even on the professional level, or and all these kinds of things, nobody drinks their Kool-Aid. Nobody buys it. But yet, on the other hand, if you look at the step-by-step kinds of things of the actual people in ERs and the stigma or the prejudice or the discrimination or whatever you want to call it, that people who have labels face every single day, it's extraordinarily real. And it comes out in so many ways. Lack of ability to get a job in Tennessee. It's actually 80,000 people in Tennessee that are not eligible for health care through Medicaid expansion. Well, a lot of those 80,000 people have real physical health needs.
Did I say 8,000 when I read your thing before? I'm sorry, yeah. I have a terrible number issue. Yes, 80,000.
There are just so many ways that if you have a label next to your name, in the place where I live, there are three main psychiatrists. One of them believes that virtually everybody is bipolar, and if you go talk to him, you're going to have bipolar disorder. Another one basically believes that nobody has bipolar disorder, that it's all a sham. And then there's a third one who's kind of in the middle, and the common joke amongst people in this community is that if you want to have bipolar disorder, here's the doctor that you need to go to. If you have it and you want to get rid of it, here's the doctor that you need to go to. And if you want to have a roll of the dice, then here's the doctor that you need to go to. And the idea that how you're diagnosed depends more on the doctor than it does on the patient, or more on the way you present, is just bizarre to me. Yeah, I don't understand how anybody in their right mind calls that science.
That's a function of Tennessee. I go there two or three times a year. Tennessee has no state income tax. Tennessee was one of those states for a long, long time that voted against even providing money for public schools. Most of the time, Tennessee does not have income tax on earned income. And like many southern states, they really believe that government should have a very limited role, and that's where it is. It's a beautiful state, but unfortunately some very conservative people, and it's a state where you go through it, and Larry, you can correct me if I'm telling things that are not true. You'll see big, in Middle Tennessee, for example, you see big billboards saying one in every five Tennesseans go to bed hungry at night. They have a very low minimum wage.
It's a state that doesn't have a lot of money because they quote unquote want to prevent the taxes to their citizens. Yet at the same time, the federal taxes that are supposed to pay for Medicaid expansion that the people in Tennessee paid, they don't take any advantage of that. State with lots. It's an extraordinarily strong Tea Party state. Extraordinarily strong. I'm in a position right now where I'm writing the governor of Tennessee every single day. It's actually on another blog that I do called Dear Governor Haslam. I'm asking him to expand Medicaid. And, there's so much about it. It's crazy,
Dear Governor who?
Dear Governor Haslam. It's DearGovernorHaslam.wordpress.com. I'll tell you my story in like 2 minutes. My wife, like I said, has been disabled her entire life. She's had SSI. Several months ago, I decided to take retirement. I turned 62 years old, and I decided to take retirement from Social Security. After about a month and a half, Social Security called me in and told us that we made way too much money. Well, we were still below poverty level, but they told me that my retirement that I'd worked 47 years for was unearned income. They told my wife that her check for $720 was going to become $20. We would lose $700. I tried to tell them that I would give my check back, and they told me, if you give it all back today, we'll do it. And I said, well, if I could give it all back today, I would never needed it to begin with. And then I told them, well, I'll just get a job. I know that you have a job in retirement, both. And I said, if you make more than $85 in a month, your wife will lose her insurance. At that point in time, we went home and we sat down and we made a budget. We figured that for the month of January, we would have $30 to live on for the entire month. For February, it would get worse, and for March, it would get worse than that. And on the day after Christmas, after 33 years of marriage, we separated to keep her alive. And we have been separated for 6 months now. And I don't know, at least in Tennessee, given what the current law is, that we will ever be able to live together. And I meet people many times who have mental health diagnoses and things like that that are in extraordinarily similar situations. The system that is supposed to help has just collapsed around them, and they're fighting to stay alive. We're fighting to stay alive. I have done my best to make as much trouble for the governor of Tennessee as I can and just basically say, hey, just talk to me. Give me 15 or 20 minutes in your office and talk to me man to man, and let me tell you what your decisions have made for my family. But all of this kind of, goes together, this notion of things being reprehensible. It's reprehensible that there is so much injustice in this world that is generated by the system that is supposed to provide justice. The mental health system is rife with it. But my experience is people who truly have mental health issues, mental health distress, mental health, whatever term you want to use, many times they're poor. Many times they are victims of massive trauma. They're victims of massive bad things that have happened in their life, and there's a system that is stacked. Not just the mental health system, but the civil system. The how do you get a job? The how do you get health care? How do you get housing? How do you do a zillion things? It's all stacked against them, and violence is done to them every single day of their life.
I'm just looking at your website, DearGovernorHaslam.wordpress.com. Larry, so are you telling me that even though you're doing this every day and you're reaching out to him every day, you're not getting a response from him?
I am not getting a response from him at this point. What happened actually for us is that somebody for the Nashville Tennessean became aware of our story, and we became the front page story in the Nashville Tennessean. From there it went to the USA Today, to Huffington Post, and I have a friend our stories actually went viral. Have a friend who kept track of the amount of places, and our story has been in something like 250 newspapers, 150 television stations, and I mean, we have gotten calls from, I've gotten calls to go on Fox News with Gretchen Carlson. I've gotten calls from MSNBC. We've gotten calls from everybody. And what I'm being told is that slowly maybe some things are moving. I don't know if they are or not. But I know that, I had a friend, not very many people know, but about 10 years ago in Tennessee, there was a sit-in in Governor Bredesen's office. He was the governor before Governor Haslam. And 12 people sat in his office because he was getting ready to cut TennCare, getting ready to cut Medicaid, and they were going to lose their insurance. All 12 of those people were going to die. Those 12 people sat down in his office for 70 days. As far as I know, it was the longest continuous sit-in in U.S. history. One of them was a good friend of mine, and I asked him, I said, you knew that Governor Bredesen was not going to change. You knew. Why did you do this? And he looked at me, he said, Larry, he said, somebody had to testify. Somebody had to say we're people and this is wrong, and somebody had to make sure that it wasn't silent. And I think that's what it's become for me. It's been, we're people, this is wrong, and it doesn't need to be silent. whether anybody listens, whether Murphy wins or loses, or anybody in Tennessee wins or loses, or regardless of what happens, you know, that when my day is done, I want to know that I stood up and that I testified and I said, this is wrong. It's wrong to hurt people. And it's wrong to hurt people just because you have power and because it serves your political interest. So, you know, I hope that it does something. I get a lot of support. I have a lot of people in Tennessee telling me that Medicaid expansion was dead until I started writing the governor and that it's starting to inch forward. Basically, it's my virtual sit-in is what it amounts to. It's my virtual sit-in. And so I write every day. And, you know, I hear lots of stories from lots of other people who are suffering from lack of Medicaid expansion. I hear lots of stories from people with mental health issues who are finding out, hey, I can't get any help. I can't get any help for physical illness. I can't get any help for the distress that I live with. What do I do? So, you know, I am truly an extremely quiet and extremely shy person. I actually sat and listened to your show for an hour before I finally said, hey, it's time to push star one, just because I'm an extraordinarily shy person. But at the same time, I want to stand up and I want to say, hey, no more, no more, no more, no more, no more, no more.
And this is not going to cost the state of Tennessee very much at all. I think for the first 5 years, I know Lauren will correct me if the number is incorrect tomorrow, but for the first many years, it's 100%.
Until 2020, it's 100% from the federal government until 2020.
And then it's 90%.
And it's 90%. But, you know, there are hospitals in this state that are losing money hand over fist because of uncompensated care and staff being cut back. And in many ways, it becomes more dangerous because you go to a hospital that even you don't know it, but maybe they don't have quite as many nurses anymore. Maybe they don't have quite as many of this or quite as many of that because they don't have the money to pay for it anymore. And so the quality of care for everybody, you know. One thing that I found out a lot of time is there's the question of, you know, do you have enough money to pay is a myth. You always pay. The question is, do you pay for the consequences or do you pay for the help? You always pay.
Right.
And, Larry, I don't know whether you follow Kentucky or not, but your neighboring state of Kentucky.
We've thought of moving, but we're in a position where I basically have no money. I basically live on a dollar
a day. No, I'm not saying moving, but I'm just trying to contrast what happened in Kentucky. In Kentucky, mm-hmm.
It's the difference between a Democratic governor and a Republican governor.
Well, they have a Democratic governor. They voted not to go ACA, but they have
the governor set up.
Yeah, the governor set up. And people that had never got physical exams, never had dental in their entire life, who were,
you know,
this was basically a red state.
I think, Larry, I want to thank you for everything that you shared and for calling in and for trusting that this could be a place where you could say no more. And I really feel like we need to be going back to that age-old question of what did these people know and when did they know it? And how do we hold them accountable for what it is that they're doing? And, you know, on a level of not being, you know, what more dehumanizing thing can a government do than refuse to respond to a request to communicate? It's the most, you know, we're like truly our subject to this government, and I think that people should know about this other website, DearGovernorHaslam.wordpress.com, and look at that because I've just been, you know, scrolling through it while we've been talking, and so obviously I can't say in any depth. But what a horrendous thing to do, and that I'm glad that you've gotten so much media attention, and I hope that Governor Haslam does the right thing and will speak to you, and that they reconsider this, and to have to be separated. I'm sorry, I didn't know this. Have to be separated from your wife in these ways, and the way the government is preventing. You know, this is the government of family, right? Like the Republicans, mm-hmm. they support family, right?
Right.
That people are having to have their families divided or torn apart.
It's a matter of life and death for Larry and his wife. This is a matter of life and death. I think.
If my wife loses her insurance, she will be dead within 30 days.
Yeah. And there are other people like this as well. I mean, we see stories like this, little children that they can't get, you know, the things that they need, and the parents are just, you know, I mean, it's a horrible thing to have happen, but when you say, it's not just a matter of being separated. It's a matter of life and death. And mm-hmm. for some kind of ideological bent to whatever your reasoning is, if you just hate the President of the United States, or if you just have this, it doesn't make sense when it's going to be paid for. It really doesn't. In other words, small hospitals in places outside of large cities like Knoxville or Chattanooga or Nashville, where they have some very small hospitals, and Larry is right, they're losing money. That's why I keep saying on Stop the Murphy Bill that the small hospital administration, they should be our allies on this, because they just losing. They don't have enough. They have to take care of the people. It makes no sense whatsoever.
But that Murphy would support this fraud of pushing money, furthering social control and pushing, tons and tons of money into the psychiatric industries and the pharmaceutical industries and all this other stuff. At the same time, refusing the Affordable Care Act. And so it's such a fraud and scam, and these people really need to be exposed for what they're doing. And Larry, I thank you for your virtual sit-in. I love that term that you're talking about, that this is your virtual sit-in, and I think that it's powerful, and that we are people that need to be treated, and our human rights need to be respected, and I agree that this is wrong, and it needs to be stopped. And so I look forward to future things that you write on HopeWorks Community, and I'll also,
I appreciate it.
Yeah, and this cannot stand, and hopefully it will happen very quickly that the governor's heart will be changed because it's...
Well, in a crazy kind of a way, if you look and you say, you have people who, because Medicaid is not expanded, are going to be dealing with issues of life and death. And then you look and you say, well, because of that stress, because of that trauma, how many of these people are going to, quote, unquote, develop mental health issues? And how many of these people are going to be able to get any help that really helps? And then you're going to be looking at, well, all of a sudden you're going to be looking at all these people that have, quote, unquote, caught all these mental illnesses, that if they have been treated decently and they have been treated fairly and they've been treated like them being a citizen counted, they would have a chance to lead fruitful and effective and happy lives. Getting sick and being poor, I mean, the combination of the two, it shouldn't be a crime. But what happens, and one of the things that I think that Representative Murphy does is he very effectively makes being poor, being in poverty, being a victim of racism, being a victim of trauma, he makes all those things a crime. You know, he makes it that, hey, we need to blame the victim.
And
that's a really sick way to look at things. And that's how it all ties together. You know, it's issues of living. It's not, it's more than mental health. It's issues of living. It's how you treat human beings, and what he would do would brutalize human beings and basically say the fact that you've had a hard time with life because of the conditions of your life is your fault.
Yeah, and Some of the clips, the audio clips that I've gotten of him and that I'm putting together, and just such horrifying, and that he would dare to call himself a psychologist. And I feel for anybody, and like that, I don't know if you were on, but apparently he made a quote on NPR saying, quote, I've seen too many of my patients die. And so I really want to know what the hell he's doing to his patients, that he's gotten too many of them that died.
But I do have a
question.
Those people are involved in care, and that's more of a testament to what he's doing, and I'd like to know that too.
Yeah, and I do have a question, Larry. So you started off the article, the letter to Representative Murphy on the meaning of reprehensible, saying that he said that it's morally reprehensible for anyone to help a patient question the medical advice a professional gives him.
Mm-hmm.
And so other people have called in the show about saying that this is now like something that's going to be affecting advocates, and there's some legal issue to this or something.
What he's trying to do, and his target are the protection and advocacy networks, the PAMI network, and places like that. And what he's basically saying is that those people need to be defunded, that they need to basically not exist. And again, in Tennessee, the protection network in Tennessee has been a big part of things. They have discovered fraud and hurtful things in the mental health system, and been a big part of things changing for the better. But, you know, basically, one of the ways that you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, Murphy, whoever, get power is if you silence the voices of those people who would disagree with you. And I think
right.
That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to silence the voices of those people who would disagree with him. And think, you know, in this country, if you try to defend somebody's rights, that's not reprehensible. It's reprehensible not to do that. And, you know, and I think that, you know, his bill attacks, you know, he basically says, we're going to do this, and one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to silence the voice of everybody who disagrees with me. And that's what the PAMI stuff is, you know, and that's what so many other things is. They don't want people to disagree with them, and they want to say, you're not going to be part of the conversation anymore. Now, again, I know personally many, many folks whose welfare have been decisively affected by the actions. You know, in Tennessee, there was a scandal with the adult group home system, where, I mean, literally you had owners of these group homes taking vacations to Europe and leaving basically bread and water for the people in these group homes to live in. And the P&A system in Tennessee found out about it, blew the horn majorly, big time, completely changed the entire system over the course of about 6 to 8 to 12 months. And if Representative Murphy had had his way, those people wouldn't exist. You know, they wouldn't exist at all.
It's so concerning, and to think that the protection advocacy is going to get wiped out in this, and that I agree with you that, you know, silencing anybody who dissents is the best way to control it and make everybody seem to be on board, because then you just get rid of anybody who disagrees, and everybody is left as either agreeing or afraid to speak out.
Murphy didn't want to say anything to Nancy Jensen. People that know Nancy Jensen wrote a book called The Girl Who Cried Wolf, and she talked about the horror place that she lived in, and this group home called the Kaufman House.
Yeah, and he was so arrogant toward her and cut her. Yeah, it was
20-plus years where these people had the people stripped down. They forced them to be filmed doing unspeakable acts. And it was only because of the TNA where Nancy and others were able to get out of the Kaufman House. They were able to have the people who ran the Kaufman House, have them charged, and they were found guilty serving. I can't remember how many years, but I know it's some decades that they're serving because of the way they ill-treated people. People tell me all the time that we're interfering with their rights. And Yvonne, these things don't happen anymore. They do. They're not and they would be happening more big time, creating an atmosphere where almost anyone can have their liberty taken away. People that really need to have medical care can't get it, or will be to family members, or will be forced to lie, force people in some kind of criminalization type of concentration camp. And as Larry says, we won't have any, any less people in prison, because there's just another kind of prison.
If you have a system,
Larry, go ahead.
If you have a system that does not respect people's right to say no, then them saying yes doesn't mean anything.
Right.
You know, my wife years ago was prescribed Abilify, and she started having all these problems, and she's telling me what these problems are, and I'm saying, Lindy, you've got akathisia. You need to go talk to this doctor and tell him what's wrong. And she went to the doctor, and she described the symptoms, and she said, I've got akathisia. And the doctor looked at her and said, well, I think you're right, you do, but you know this medicine is really controlling your symptoms. Why don't we increase the dosage? She looked at him and she said, you know what, you've answered one of my questions. And he said, what question is that? She said, I know now which one of us is crazy. And she got up and walked out. You know, if you don't have the right to say no, saying yes doesn't mean anything. And when, if you take a statute that says you no longer have the right to say no, you no longer have the right, I mean, they let people who have cancer, who are dying, say no. They let people who have all kinds of diseases say no, you know. And people just have the right to say no, you know. And there's just not a big enough stick to beat people with to make them do things, you know. I mean, and so I think that's part of the problem. That's one of the reasons that the attack against the PNA people is so vicious, because it does something about that right to say no, you know. And you know, I think that's what America is supposed to be built on. Is
right, it's the corporation, you know, of the United States of America. Sure.
Yeah. That's what I think.
I agree with you, and I think that this is you know, the right to say no is absolutely huge, but that there, it goes beyond around reporting abuse and silencing people in those ways, which and for those facts, the PAMI are so essential to making sure that people are protected and also themselves overburdened with reports of abuse and neglect
and they're unfunded
such,
and they're
but also
underfunded.
Yes, and they're definitely underfunded. But also this idea that just simply telling somebody to question or assisting somebody in the questioning of the medical advice that they're getting, that is, that Murphy considers that morally reprehensible. So it's not only, it's like, isn't that what a second opinion, I mean,
mm-hmm.
In every other field of quote-unquote medicine, you're encouraged to get a second opinion, to go make sure that this is the right diagnosis, that this is
mm-hmm.
the right course of, you know, quote-unquote treatment that somebody is getting. And then still, as you mentioned, have the right to refuse chemo or anything else for that matter.
Anosognosia.
Anosognosia.
You listen to Tori, half the people who are mentally ill don't know it.
That's so right. And so here, let me just, here, can I, if I can have a minute of your time.
Dr. Sharon, I'm just not clear. Are you a clinician that treats patients? No, I'm a research psychologist. Okay, thank you. You said SAMHSA does not support programs that are anti-treatment. Are you familiar with the Alternatives Conference?
I am.
Are you aware that Alternatives is short for Alternatives to Treatment?
It's my interpretation of alternatives, it's not alternatives to treatment, it's alternatives available for people to make choices about how to best engineer their recovery.
Do you think everybody is capable of making that choice?
I think everybody is capable of understanding what's important to them.
You've constantly referred to something called anosognosia. Do you know what that is?
I've heard it described. Yeah.
Okay, I'm disappointed you don't know what it is. It's critically important. So I got to go into a little lesson here. If a person has a stroke, on the right side of their brain and the left side of their arm doesn't work, a characteristic of that is if you say to your best person, try and move your left arm, and they don't, you say, I think you're having a stroke, you need to get to the hospital. The person may say, it's no big deal, I don't know what that's all about. That's anosognosia.
I wrote another blog post that I wrote. I did the math about New York. If you do the math and you say that so many people are seriously mentally ill that 50% of them have anosognosia. In the state of New York, that means that there should be 382,000 people with anosognosia. If you look and you see that AOT serves 2,000 people, that means there's 380,000 people with anosognosia that are missing.
That's right, not to mention the 171,000 people who every week, according to their statistics, are getting, quote-unquote, served. It's horrifying. And that was in the testimonies where Nancy Jensen also testified, and that was Shern, and where they were going after... Where they were going after the SAMHSA funding and everything else, but this idea of how Murphy winds up doing it, I just want to, if I can play this clip here, if I can find it, here it is.
If you're having a stroke, you need to get to the hospital. The person may say, it's no big deal, I don't know what that's all about. That's anosognosia. About 40 to 50% of people with severe mental illness, schizophrenia, if shown a videotape of them hallucinating, delusional, they don't know who they are, they think they're an angel Gabriel, Jesus, whatever else, and they say, do you think that's okay? They'll say, sounds okay to me, I don't understand the problem. What is Thompson's referring to for those people who are not capable of making decisions on their own, to have someone else assist them so that they have a right to get better? Would you agree that such persons may need some assistance that they're not capable of making on their own?
And so there's like the immediate, correlation between this caricature of a spiritual experience that people have then being demonized as, something that is the definition of what somebody who's not aware of the fact that they need a psychiatric intervention are like. And I think that what Murphy is doing is just so criminal, and that he needs to be held accountable. Not only does H.R. 3717 need to be just taken out of the race here, but that Murphy needs to be accountable for the damage that he's doing by using his license to perpetrate these fraud on the American people.
I wonder if he's still seeing patients. Do you know if he is?
I don't know, but I know that he's seen too many of his patients die, and I really hope that maybe tomorrow, I was informed today that his press secretary was going to get back to me about what patients died and what he was referring to, but his press secretary did not call me back today, so maybe tomorrow he will. I don't know.
He invoked HIPAA. Isn't that one of the laws that he wants to change?
The HIPAA laws?
Yes. Yeah. If they do invoke HIPAA, I would remind them that we're asking how many, not who.
That's right. That's a good point, Yvonne. How many, not who. How much did you know, and when did you know it? And just.
I'm in a position where I've got to go. I want to thank you for giving me a chance to talk.
Oh, well, Larry, I thank you so much for joining in, and anytime I'm gonna I'm following your blog, and I'm hoping looking forward to new things, and I hope that Governor Haslam agrees to meet with you, and that the situation for yourself and your wife is resolved in the most best and possible way, and I wish you both luck, and see you.
Thank you so much. You guys take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, he's a real sweet guy.
What a tragedy. And, this is wrong. This is wrong. And people can go to what Larry described as his virtual sit-in at deargovernorhaslam.wordpress.com. And Haslam is spelled H-A-S-L-A-M. And then also his HopeWorks community page on WordPress, and I think that everybody should read and share and reshare Larry Drain's letter, Dear Representative Murphy, on the meaning of reprehensible, and that the points that he made in this letter really point out why this is such a fraud, and why H.R. 3717 needs to be stopped in its tracks.
They're really heartless. whole, he, Murphy and his other, the triad, they hold themselves out to care so much about, I put in quotes, people who have mental illness. They hold themselves out to care so much, but yet they won't provide for decent health care for poor people. Who they care so much, they would rather be involved in some extreme intervention versus help people who are willingly wanting to get health care.
It really is a shame, and that people's lives are literally on the line. People have been put on drugs that have caused devastating diseases that were unnecessary based on total fraud in the first place, and then when they're needing assistance, medical, real, true, actual medical assistance, they're being refused and having to do all kinds of degrading, dehumanizing things in order to stay alive. And for a party that supports family the way that it does, to think what it is that they're causing people to have to do, and how people are support is just ripped away from people when they most need it. It's just horrendous, and that's reprehensible, and it's wrong, and people need to know about it and speak out. And I hope that for all of you who are listening tonight and called in and talked, that you will continue to speak out here and everywhere where you are. You know, for those of you who are sharing such great information on Facebook and writing your own pieces or just responding to other things that have been written, if you'd like to schedule time to be a guest, or if you have an idea for a show, or if you know of a human rights violation or a death that you think needs to be exposed, you can call the Talk with Tenny tip line at area code 718-273-8708. Yvonne, we just have a couple of minutes left, and so I wanted to get to that UK article that you posted. I finally found it. And so, yeah, so the British Psychological Society, so yes, Murphy would be a psychologist. So this would be the same people that are about to, quote, launch attack on rival profession, casting down on the biomedical model of mental illness. And
I'm going to be following that very closely. That's from The Guardian and The Observer, very respected newspaper in the United Kingdom. This is not Onion, but a very respected newspaper. And, you know, we first saw in the United Kingdom stories about the black, before we had black box warnings on the drugs for teenagers, we saw this in the United Kingdom first. And so I'm going to be following this very closely, and I'll probably be sending you and posting on Facebook some other information at YZSmith on Facebook.com as this comes across. I've been tracking various stories on the Internet about mental health. Some of them use diagnosis. Some of them do not, because there is a effort, I feel, to try to brainwash people to feel as though that that there is evidence that there is a biochemical, or this is a real illness, and people keep trying to repeat it. So it's very refreshing to see that a professional organization like the British Society of Psychologists are doing this. And you comment several times, Lauren, about NIMH coming out and saying that there's no evidence. And I know a lot of people find this
Intel said that there was no validity, right, that there was no validity in the DSM. And there is no validity. And that's... Yeah, so this British Psychological Society making these kinds of statements, it looks like a great article, and I think you're right. I think it's something that we should be following, and that we should be attempting to get the American Psychological Association there, right, to kind of come out. Although there are some radical sects inside of the American Psychological.
And the Psychological for Social Responsibility is one group.
That's right. there are people who are speaking out, and I think more and more people are beginning to say that, you know, you can't continue to present this as fact when it's not. And that's the big problem here, is that they are saying that what they are presenting is fact, and what they are in fact presenting is opinion, and the fact is that they have no evidence for any of it. I just want going out. I want to remind people that we're going to be having a series of shows that the dates will be announced in the near future on United Nations activity and on the conventions, the rights of persons with disabilities, the Convention Against Torture, the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, and all other kinds of Convention Against Violence Against Women, and how they are applying. And so we're going to be setting up a series on information about the work going on at the international level. And then also Ron Leifer is going to be coming on and doing a show soon, and I will be trying to set that up and get dates out. But I think right now our priority is calling your representatives. There's been requests from the National Coalition for people to call your representatives in the next week and make sure that they know that you don't want them supporting H.R. 3717, and to go to town hall meetings. And if town hall meetings aren't being held while session is out, to organize them yourself and invite your representatives to them. We need to be speaking out and making our voices as loudly and clearly that we are opposed to H.R. 3717 as we can. And I just really want to reiterate that I'm hoping that Murphy's press secretary will be getting back to me tomorrow, I hope. I will call again, if not, obviously, trying to get some kind of comments about his statement that too many of his patients have died. And I just want to play this one more time for people before we close, on the off chance that you hadn't heard it at the beginning of the show. So here is Congressman Murphy talking with Laura Sullivan on All Things Considered on NPR. May 29th and 30th, 2014.
I was going to do something. Because Adam Lanza and the other people who have nowhere to go, who have not gotten treatment, who have not gotten a diagnosis, are out there dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? I have seen too many of my patients die. Adam Lanza and the other people who have nowhere to go, who have not gotten treatment, who have not gotten a diagnosis, are dying with their rights on. Are you kidding me? I have seen too many of my patients die.
And so, I don't know, I think there are a few people who are curious about what Murphy is talking about, and to remind people that this is not limited to people who are psychiatrically diagnosed. The goal of H.R. 3717 and certainly the goal of H.R. 4574 is to diagnose as many people as possible and to get them to comply with psychiatry, and that this is a step, another step of Americans losing our civil liberties and our rights. Yvonne, as always, love talking with you. Thank you so much for calling in and for sharing everything that you do and all the information that you bring. Larry, thanks for calling in again. If you have a tip or would like to be on the show or know of a human rights violation you would like to have exposed, you can call the Talk with Tenney tip line at area code 718-273-8708, 24 hours a day, except when we are on air. That's 718-273-8708. I want to thank you all for speaking out, ask you to keep on speaking out, and until we talk to you next time, talk to you soon. Good night, everyone. Thank you.